Milton Mathis is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute Mathis by injecting him with massive doses of drugs, usually used to save lives. Over the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the state killing. Attorneys for Mathis say he is mentally retarded, which would make his execution illegal. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubik, Houston Vigil reporter David Atwood, and special interview guest Claudia Whitman, co-author of The Capital Defense Handbook. The Execution Watch begins.
And good evening. This is Ray Hill. You're listening to radio station KPFT Houston. That's the 90.1 FM. You can listen to us on HD Channel 2, or you can get us on the Internet at two locations, kpft.org or executionwatch.org. And we're in here. I'm surrounded by Larry and Susan and Jim. We've got a legal team here ready to pry into this case and its legal history. But first, we do, as our ritual requires, we check in with Gloria Rubak, who is our reporter on the ground in Huntsville. Gloria, this is Ray. How's it going?
Hi, Ray. Here in Huntsville. Well, nothing's going so far. It looks
good.
Like it's straight up 6 o'clock. The crime scene tape is up, but that stays up until there's a stay or until there's an execution. So I have to beg to differ with how you opened the show when you or somebody said by the end of the show Milton Mathis will be dead.
That may not be true today.
That absolutely may not be true. His case has been before the Supreme Court since yesterday. They obviously have had something happening. I don't know if they discuss it or what they do, but they haven't ruled yet. And until they do, this execution isn't going to take place.
Gloria, would you explain to the audience out there what's cooking? What are we looking for at this point, whether we know or not the execution is going to proceed?
Well, at this point, what we're looking for is to see if the witnesses cross 12th Street from the prison administration building and walk into the walls unit where the death house is located. Until we see the media walk across the street and perhaps his family or friends walk across who are going to witness, then nothing's happening. So I am hoping that I don't see anybody walk across the street.
Yeah, actually, we always hope that.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, we always hope that because the folks who put together Execution Watch and our folks who help us, like Gloria, our reporter on the ground in Huntsville, are folks that are not enthusiastic about executing people in any case. It gets real ticklish. In this case, we have some legitimacy to the claim of mental retardation.
Exactly. And actually, the test that said that Milton's IQ was 62, given by TDCJ.
Right.
And so even if you factor in it 4 points above or below, even if it's 4 points above that, the man still has the mental capabilities of you or I and should not be executed. I think that what has happened in his case and what happens in so many cases, 9 out of 10 guys on death row could not hire an attorney, much less did not have a dream team to adequately defend them. So whether you're guilty or innocent, if you don't have the money for lawyers, you can wind up on the gurney with a needle arm. And that's just how.
Actually, he got a stay in 2005.
Right.
That was predicated on this issue. And what I think, Gloria, is that I hope for the best, But now we have, instead of an execution watch show, we have a breaking news story here.
Right.
Hopefully with a good resolve. So, Gloria, let me put you on hold and let Elizabeth keep in touch with you as we analyze the legal history of this case.
Okay, and I just want to give a message to the guys on death row who are now able to listen to the show. I want you to know that no matter what happens, there are people out here protesting these executions and doing a lot of stuff before we even
fighting execution is a full-time business.
It is.
And some of us do not rest. I want to apologize to the guys that are listening. I wasn't here in the last show because I had a conflicting television show that I had to do. But I am here tonight, and I'll be here on July the 7th for Umberto. And so we're going to continue this discussion. But Gloria, I'm going to put you on hold.
Okay, wait. I don't know if you heard the latest good news. Governor Perry just signed the bill that gives Anthony Graves his compensation.
Oh, no. When did that happen?
I got a phone call a few minutes ago, and they said it came across in a Chronicle article at like 4:30 or 4:40.
Okay, well, the guys on the row will be glad to hear from that. So I'm going to put you on hold, Gloria. I'm not going to hang up, but I'll put you on hold. Okay. Let Elizabeth talk to you, and if y'all work out the arrangement so we know what's happening, if anything happens.
Okay.
Bye-bye. And actually, we hope nothing happens, because that's a good thing. Let me get Dave in. I guess, Elizabeth, Dave, are you there?
I'm here.
I guess Elizabeth told you that there ain't nothing going on about the street crossing in Huntsville.
Yeah.
And so we're in a holding pattern.
Okay.
Do you mind if I put you on hold? And hopefully I'll get you to comment on a breaking news story of a secured stay here in a minute.
Okay, fine.
Thank you, Dave. Always give Dave and Gloria a chance to rehearse their lines. And speaking for those who do not have time, we've got in the room, we've got Susan Ashley, and we've got Larry...
Douglas.
I don't know why I have trouble with Douglas.
Not a problem.
I noticed that one of the justices of the Supreme Court got one of Douglas's Bibles given to him by a rich benefactor. And that's grazing a stink. And Jim Skelton, of course. Who gets first chair? Susan is here with pen post. Okay, Jim.
Let me think about the only thing I have reason. I think they might.
Let me get a microphone here. Okay, there you go.
Okay.
Now you're on.
Got it. I wouldn't be surprised if they grant a stay, and let me tell you why. It's kind of a complicated mess. The Supreme Court about 2 weeks ago granted a hearing on a case out of Arizona. And the big issue has always been, what if your writ lawyer messes up? Can you claim ineffective assistance of counsel? In the Arizona case, what had happened, because of mess-ups by the lawyer that filed the state writs, he never got a federal review. It was too late to get a federal review. And so they sent the case back to see if the Arizona procedure doesn't violate the Sixth Amendment and whether or not you're entitled to effective assistance counsel at the writ level. And this is why they may grant a stay in this case. Let me explain why.
Wait a minute. Before you do that, let's ask a few questions. What is a writ lawyer?
Okay, that's what I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
To review how a federal death penalty case is appealed, here's what happens. After a verdict is returned by a trial level, it automatically goes to the Court of Criminal Appeals. Mm-hmm. That's called a direct appeal. And the most critical part of a death penalty case is a punishment hearing. And when the direct appeal goes up, they're limited to anything that was brought up at the trial itself. And they can't go beyond the parameters of that. After that case is affirmed by the Court of Criminal Appeals, at that point, the defendant can go back into court and file what we call a post-conviction writ in the trial judge. At that point, they can expand evidence they might have gathered in the meantime. Now, here's what happens. After that federal writ, the state writ is over with, then they can go into federal court on a federal writ. Here's the problem. Once the Court of Criminal Appeals on direct appeal affirms a case, you've only got 1 year to file a federal writ. After that, you're barred from filing a federal writ. Now, they stay that time level during the time your state writ is pending. So here's what happened in this case. His case was affirmed on direct appeal several years before Atkins came out. Atkins is the case that says it violates the Sixth Amendment to execute a retarded person.
Okay.
And that was never an issue on the direct appeal. It was never an issue at the state writ level. It was never litigated at that point because Atkins wasn't on the books at that point. At that point. Now, what happened, the year timetable was coming up on the federal writ, and they filed a federal writ. And at that point, the federal writ was not based upon any Atkins issue because it had been brought up in state court then. Now, what occurred, after they filed the federal writ, Atkins came out. Now, when Atkins hit, the lawyers go back into court and file a second writ of habeas corpus. Now, normally you can't file a second writ unless the law has changed. Well, the law has changed under Atkins. Well, when they filed a second writ, the Court of Criminal Appeals turned them down. So there's an execution date. What happened, the lawyers who filed the federal writ go into federal court and ask for a stay of execution. The judge dismissed the stay of execution and didn't realize when the judge did so, this also dismissed the federal writ.
Oh.
So what happened, at that point, nothing has been litigated on the Atkins issue, either in state or federal court at that point, but the federal writ had been dismissed.
So how is this case left over? I mean, we've been talking about Atkins.
I'm not finished with it yet.
Okay.
So what happened, they go back into court on a third writ, and at that point, the Court of Criminal Appeals grants them an Atkins hearing. And they have about a 3-day hearing to determine whether or not that he is mentally retarded under the Texas law.
And this is a hearing in appellate court or in
trial
court?
How it works, when the writ is filed, it's filed in the convicting court. And the convicting court conducts a hearing.
Okay.
And then what happens after the hearing is conducted, it's the Court of Criminal Appeals that makes the decision based on the evidence gathered at the hearing.
Okay. So all the trial court does, or the original court does, is gather the evidence and pass it on for the juries up there.
Well, they do something else that's important. They'll make recommendations and make fact findings. For example, if there's a conflict, they're going to resolve the conflict. The conflict on fact, they'll resolve that. And the Court of Criminal Appeals is bound to that by that ruling, so long as the record supports it. Now, what happened at the third writ hearing is when they developed all the evidence about the mental retardation. And so at that point, the defense claimed he had an IQ of 62 that was done by TDC. The state goes back and talks about other things. He had an IQ of 79 when he was in school. And they also claimed that the reason his IQ was low is because self-induced use of drugs. He'd been accused of smoking marijuana laced with PCP, marijuana laced with embalming fluid, and that rarely ever increases your IQ. So what happened is the writ judge recommended that they not grant the writ, that he was not mentally retarded, because to be mentally retarded by itself is not sufficient. You got to be mentally retarded, meaning an IQ of 70 or below.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, you have to have lack of adaptive skills.
Mm-hmm.
And these problems must occur before you reach the age of 18. Well, his IQ prior to 18 was 79. His IQ after 18 was 62. So what happened, the Court of Criminal Appeals ruled that he did not qualify to be mentally retarded to escape the death penalty.
Well, you may be retarded, but it's your fault and not ours.
Well, it's kind of, I call it affirmative action. Since you're African-American, they had extra points to your IQ.
Okay.
It's called affirmative action in death penalty cases. And so what happened, he asked the Fifth Circuit if he can file a second writ. Now, here's the problem. All federal courts do in those writs, they do not review what the state court does, say yea or nay. They look at the evidence presented at the state level and ask this question. Was a ruling by the state judges a reasonable application of federal law? That doesn't mean they agree with the ruling. What it basically means is there some evidence support the judge's finding. Well, in this case, there was evidence on the other side. He didn't qualify for being mentally retarded. So they granted him the opportunity to file a second writ, but the federal district court dismissed it because in federal court, you can file but one writ. So there was a screw-up on the appellate procedure, and that case out of Arizona may give them a break. Now, Susan, I've asked her to talk about the mental retardation issue. She knows it on both sides, what's pro pro-mental retardation, what's anti-mental retardation. I've asked her to discuss that. But that's why there may be a stay granted, because of that little glitch in the appellate procedure about him not having the federal
courts. So the stay may not be about mental retardation itself. It may be a procedural stay.
Exactly.
Based on... but I still go back to my original question. We've been talking about Atkins for a good many years here, and this case has just stuck out on that issue.
Well, Susan is the one I've asked to talk about the retardation part.
Okay, you play with Atkins.
Okay. Mr. Mathers, when he first went to school in the first grade, he, right off the bat, he had problems. He had academic problems, disciplinary problems, and he obviously was not functioning or performing near what other children were. So he was held back in the first grade. His history after that is he continues really to have academic problems. He continues to have disciplinary problems. He had trouble with the reading, writing, completing simple math. He had trouble doing sort of basic things like dressing himself, cleaning himself, just managing like the daily life, you know, tasks. When he was in fifth grade, he was 12 years old, and at that time he was referred for an evaluation. He was given like IQ tests, and at that time the results were, they said he scored a 79 on his IQ test. After that, well, he continues to struggle in school. It doesn't really get any better. And he drops out in school really by the ninth grade. By the ninth grade, he's basically failing. He's held back again in ninth grade. And he later drops out of school. At age 22, he's given a test at TDCJ. And on that test, he scores 62. Now, the state would argue that as a result of significant drug use, that he essentially poisoned his brain, and that the lower IQ score is a result of him voluntarily using drugs, which lowered his score.
Okay, Susan, before you go on, I have a report that our producer, Elizabeth, has discovered. The appeal is pending before the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. At this point, today the Supreme Court denied Mathis's two petitions and three stay requests, but there is still a stay pending before the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals on some issue. I don't have on that. Could you scroll this down, Elizabeth? Scroll it up so that I can. All we have is that there is a stay pending before the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. And we don't know what that's about. Can you speculate?
I can speculate on that because the Court of Criminal Appeals has already heard what the writ judge gathered on what Susan, the evidence that Susan talked about. They've already heard that.
Mm-hmm.
And they've already ruled in that particular case that he doesn't qualify as being mentally retarded. Now, they might have granted a stay pending.
Maybe this is a Justice Keller thing, and they all quit and went home at 5 o'clock, and they're not open for business.
They might have granted the stay pending the outcome of the Supreme Court hearing. That could be it.
And then they went home.
Went home, probably.
Let me tell you something. This is sometimes fascinating, and sometimes it's pretty scary, actually. I'm sorry, Susan, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but...
I'll continue. Okay. An IQ test is given at TDCJ. He's 22 years old at the time. He scores a 62 on this IQ test. But in addition to this IQ test, prison records also indicate that he had certain cognitive impairments, and he appears, which they attributed to a history of drug use, and that he had what they call significant limitations in his adaptive behavior in terms of his conceptual understanding, social adaptive behavior, and his practical skills, which I assume would be like his practical sort of life living skills. And then later, the next shall we say, expert or test appears to be at a habeas proceeding, that there was an expert, a forensic psychologist, that administered five different tests, and essentially what they concluded was he had a score of 64, which is only a little 2 points higher than the TDC test. But he clearly, almost all, everyone that evaluated him would also indicated that there were certain limitations in his functioning ability. Now, on the other side, what the state would probably, did argue, I guess, is that he probably lowered his IQ by years of drug abuse, and that he had the ability to lie. The state said he had the ability, he could have sex, he could lie, he could babysit, and steal dogs, and that was evidence that he was not mentally retarded. And
that those very same things could be evidence that he was mentally retarded.
Well, the argument...
I've got a question. Does the mental retardation go back to the time of the crime and his mental culpability at the time of the crime? Or does the mental retardation apply to his knowing whether or not or why he's being executed?
That has nothing to do with it. What it basically, mental retardation, to qualify under the Atkins case,
yeah,
you got to have an IQ 70 or below.
Yeah.
Combined with the inability to have what they call adaptive skills.
Sure.
Plus, it's got to have something that occurred before you're 18, so you got to be mentally retarded before you commit the crime.
Okay.
And if you have these things at the onset of all these problems begin before the age of 18, in other words, they don't want you faking them, because if you're taking an IQ test to see whether you're going to be executed or not, you're not going to score real high. It's not like an
you're not motivated.
No,
to shoot
it's not like an admission
right.
test okay. to get into school.
Yeah. Well, I have taken an IQ test on being entered in prison. And I made the strategic decision to do very well on the IQ test. I could have done that very poorly, I suppose. Let me do something about Dave. Dave, are you hearing what we're talking about here?
No.
Okay, well, let me tell you what's going on. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has a pending stay as of 5:35 p.m.
Okay.
The Supreme Court of the United States late this afternoon denied Mathis's two petitions and three stay requests. So the Supreme Court has washed his hands. I mean, this is a Pontius Pilate thing. They washed their hands of it and passed it on. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and we were speculating that maybe it's a Judge Keller situation where they issued a stay pending the Supreme Court and then closed shop at 5 o'clock and went home.
Ah, how about that?
Yeah,
that'd be interesting.
That would be a different twist on that thing. How many people have you got out there?
We got seven people out here.
And where is here?
Here is the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd out in front of St. Anne's Catholic Church. And it's a very heavy travel area. We get a lot of cars coming by, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cars. And we get a pretty darn good response from everybody. I mean, every now and then you'll get a negative response, but overwhelming, which is really interesting, overwhelming, we get thumbs up from the people where they honk their horns. And we don't have signs that say honk your horn if you agree with us. They just do it automatically.
They do that automatically. I know. Yeah. I would do that if I were passing by.
Yeah, and so it's a very, it's really encouraging actually to be out here and to see the positive response from most of the people that go by. You know, thumbs up, honking horn. That's dramatically different than it was if you go back 20 years ago when we first started coming out for these vigils.
Okay, Dave. I hope that the news that we don't have when we get it will be good news. I hope there is no execution today.
Okay, I hope so too. Okay, thanks, Ray.
Thank you, Dave.
You take care. Bye-bye.
And that was Dave Atwood from the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty in Houston. Previously, we heard from Gloria Ruback from the Abolition Movement, and she is in Huntsville. And Elizabeth is finding out what she can find by chasing the notes and information from the Attorney General's office about the state habeas, subsequent state habeas application before the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. And that's why, thus far, we have had no action in this case. We're rapidly approaching the point where it is unlikely that the execution will continue. That is a reality. It is now 6:25 in Houston and in Huntsville, and at some point they're going to declare recess, and this execution is stopped. That has not happened yet. A stay is pending, and when it comes down, and it can come down in either direction, and either the execution would proceed. I notice that Elizabeth is on the cell phone, probably talking to Glory in Huntsville or the Attorney General's office to see what she can find out so we can share that with you. This is not an exact science.
Well, see, one thing is even worse than we haven't discussed. The judges that decide whether or not somebody's retarded, it's a judge's decision. He's going to be influenced by the facts of the case. And the facts of this case are pretty egregious, because what happened, there was a kid by the name of Chris Lynch that apparently had a crack house, running a crack house over in Fort Bend County. Had a couple of guys he rented rooms to by the name of Travis Brown and one by the name of Daniel Hibbard. And what happened, about 8:30 that morning, a woman by the name of Mrs. Lester and her 15-year-old daughter go by the house. When she arrives, Milton Mathis is there, and he's back in Travis Brown's bedroom. She doesn't see him. And Chris Lynch lets him inside the house, and they're sitting on the couch visiting. And then Lynch goes to the kitchen, hears a gunshot coming from Brown's bedroom. At that point, Mathis walks out carrying a .45 pistol. He claims that Brown had shot himself in the head. At that point, Chris Lynch says, put the gun down. He pulls the gun on all of them, takes the lady back, the woman and her child, takes the other roommate, Daniel Hipper, back, and takes Chris Lynch back into Lynch's bedroom. At that point, he walks up to the 15-year-old girl and shoots her in the head with a .45. Mm. She survives, but is paralyzed from the neck down. He then turns around and shoots Daniel Hibbard in the head and kills him. At that point, of course, he's already killed Brown. At that point, he turns the girl on the gun on Chris Lynch, and apparently it wouldn't misfire out a bullet. Something didn't happen. He also pointed the gun at the woman, at the mother of the girl he just shot. Again, the gun wouldn't fire. And it's either out of shells or out of bullets. So he killed two people, shot one in the head that's paralyzed from the neck down. He then rummages through the house, and then he sets the room on fire, Chris Brown's room on fire, and leaves in Brown's Cadillac. And so the police pick him up. When they pick him up, there's a big struggle, there's a big fight. They discover, after talking to the witnesses, that Mathis was, and this is some of the stuff that hurts him on cognitive ability, he had convinced his father to lie for him, try to set up an alibi. His father wouldn't do it. He also convinced his girlfriend to set up an alibi, and initially she stood by the alibi until the police leaned on her, then she changed her story. So what happened, he at least had the skills, mental skills, to try to figure out a way to get out of what he had done. And this is what's really bizarre about this case. During the trial, he demanded and wanted to testify. He takes a stand, and his initial story is, I went by the crack house earlier. I was not at the crack house when the killings took place. His lawyer is a guy we call Rocket Rosen.
Yeah.
Asked for a recess. Yeah. Take him out in the hallway and talks to him. Then at that point, Mathis gets back on the stand and says, I lied in the first part of my testimony. Here's really what happened. I was back in Brown's bedroom. Brown pulled a gun on me and held it to my head. I pushed the gun away and took the gun away from him. Then when Brown approached me, I shut my eyes and shot him in self-defense. And then I panicked, and when I panicked, I went out and shot the other people. That was his new story. Of course, the jury didn't buy any of that. And those facts, I don't care how human you are, going to affect how you're going to feel when you decide whether somebody qualifies for the death penalty or not. Because these facts are pretty egregious. Plus, he was 19 years old, was already on probation for robbery. And they proved up all this trouble and fights and assaults he got into in school. He also got in fight with jailers. He didn't behave while he was in jail also.
And there's a jailhouse snitch in here somewhere.
And a jailhouse snitch. The bad thing about that, a jailhouse snitch testified that Brown was never showed any remorse. I mean, Mathis never showed any remorse and said he should have killed all of them. And that didn't help any.
We have a report from Huntsville. Gloria, are you there? Gloria.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, actually, there is absolutely nothing to report, Ray. Huntsville is quiet. The cops are hanging loose. They're texting. They're talking. They're laughing. And
nobody's coming out of the old administration building.
Nobody has come out, and I think that the cops would be put on alert if the media was going to walk out. And at this point, they are not on any kind of alert at all. So the Huntsville Item reporter just went home. So there's really nothing to say.
Well, the Huntsville Item reporter, is that Grazik? No.
No. He's the Associated Press.
Okay.
No, it was a young student named Megan,
okay,
who just got hired. So she took her pictures and interviewed us and left.
Okay. So as far as you know, there's absolutely no action. Now, have we been through this before, where a stay was handed down?
Yeah, we have actually.
Well, I know we've been for a stay, but somebody has something solid about it. By now, and this is a time we don't have anything solid about it.
I remember a couple of summers ago being out here till almost midnight before TDC actually called off the execution. And you know, I can't remember his name, maybe you can, but it was the case where the judge and the DA in Collin County were sleeping together when the man was being tried.
Yeah, I remember that case, yeah.
I think it was the Hood case.
And I don't know
Hood
why case. His name won't come to me, but
Hood.
Nothing had been settled, and by 11, oh my God. Damn. I have a feeling the execution is happening. I see people with, there's Michael Grace, Doggett. Okay, Ray, it looks like the execution is happening.
Grazik is going across the road.
They are crossing, that is Michael Grazik. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 members of the media are crossing the street. Oh, man. I was so hoping we'd be here till 11:15, and then they'd say, okay, go home.
It is now 6:32, apparently, from our reporter Gloria Ruback in Huntsville. The ritual crossing of the road by the media is at this time taking place. The execution will proceed. By ritual, we know that because this is the way these things work. When they cross the road, the last stay, the last hold has been removed, and the procedure will begin. Thank you, Gloria.
Okay. I'm wondering if his mother and family are going to witness. I don't know. I know he had family visiting for the last visits, but I'm not sure who's witnessing for him. So, and so far nobody else has crossed
okay.
the street yet. Okay, so...
You will be back in touch with Elizabeth if there is developments to report.
Yeah, and it looks like execution number 470 will take place.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate
okay.
the support.
Bye-bye.
Well, we didn't get the news we wanted, but we are now... Execution watch again. We were a breaking news story about what happens in the event of a stay. Any surprise?
I thought maybe the Supreme Court might grant a stay because of the Arizona case. They granted one last week on the same issue. Although the lawyers never argued on the appellate level that the appellate lawyer messed up. They just simply said there was a glitch in the appellate procedure. They never said that the appellate lawyers were incompetent. I mean, and that's exactly what was the issue brought up in the Arizona case. Can you claim ineffective assistant counsel on the post-conviction writ procedure? And all they were talked about was a glitch in the proceedings. And the glitch occurred when they asked for a stay of execution while the federal writ was pending. The judge denied it and thereby dismissed the writ, which meant once that federal writ was over with, it's real difficult to get a second writ. And at that point, they hadn't litigated in state court the mental incompetency issue. And it was later litigated.
Jim, what are they weighing here? Are they weighing the nature of the crime? They're weighing all of that?
Well, again, as Susan went over some of the stuff, there was arguments on both sides. They're going to look at his conduct. For example, his conduct in having the ability to escape from the crime, his conduct in trying to get his father to lie on his behalf, his conduct of trying to get his girlfriend to set up an alibi for him, his conduct, and then they're going to look at his conduct, especially the drug usage, because what do? If someone's slow to begin with, and then they start taking drugs, that perhaps very well could lower their IQ. Mm-hmm. And the point is, if you're taking an IQ test, as I said earlier, knowing that if you score high, they're going to kill you, that's not much of a motivation to do well on an IQ test. And at least he scored a 79 on his IQ back when he's in the fifth grade. And again, they look at that conduct. That's the reason they have that cutoff age for 18, because you got to have that inability, that mental lack of mental ability prior to the age of 18. You can't later fake it and come in and claim that you're mentally retarded to avoid the consequences of your conduct. And I think, again, I'd like for Larry Douglas to comment on this.
Yeah, speaking, go to Larry and ask Larry if he had any insight in all of this.
The specifics about the impact of the crime itself on the judges and decide mental retardation.
Well, I clearly the seriousness of the crime had a lot to do with it. But by the same token, I think that whole issue of mental retardation, when you look at how he scored, not when the TDCJ examined him, but really as a younger boy. It's my feeling that when you balance that against the offense itself, that's really what really caused it.
What do you think about his ability to be cunning enough to try to get someone to help him out of it, getting his father to lie for him and getting his girlfriend to lie for him? Do you think that might have been a factor?
I think it was a major factor. I mean, he did a lot. It's like the old, flight is evidence of guilt, a knowledge of guilt. I mean, not only did he run away, but he did a lot of different things that would suggest that he had the ability, at least. It did not appear that he was particularly, extremely mentally retarded. That gave that impression, particularly with all of the things he did, maybe one or two of them, but he did quite a bit.
Well, okay, his behavior after the shooting, the deception, it was consistent, because after the shooting, he came out, and the first thing he said is Travis shot him in the head.
Shot himself.
Right. Travis shot him. Okay. So that was clearly a lie to take away from his, criminal culpability. The next thing that we didn't mention is he apparently set Brown's room on fire.
I'd mention that. Yeah.
Okay. And that would be an attempt to maybe cover up the evidence or the crime or something like that. That's probably, one would say that's probably what he was thinking. He tried to get his father to lie and his girlfriend to lie, and then he himself took the stand and lied at trial. So it's kind of a consistent, shall we say, behavior to lower his criminal culpability.
Yeah, well, I mean,
he did so many different things. There were a lot of things that he did.
I think earlier you said, Larry, that the fact that showed he's retarded what he did at trial. That's what he's mentioned.
In terms of
insisting on testifying for himself, that doesn't sound.
Larry's theory was he couldn't follow the instructions of his lawyer, and lawyer never put him on the stand.
Well, then that's somebody's retarded there. The question is who? Elizabeth, is this Claudia that's on the air? I don't know. Elizabeth is on the phone. Oh, she's talking to somebody on the phone. We have a guest called Claudia Whitman. Those of you who tuned in to get Mishukaku's exploration, sorry about that. It got preempted by serious evidence of an execution tonight. We almost dodged that bullet, that we didn't. This program is now at 6:39. at 7 o'clock sharp, we're going to be vacating the studio, and Coming to America will appear magically, and that leads us into the Umberto Leal case, which is the next execution scheduled, and there was a lot of brouhaha about conducting conversations with consuls in that case, and there's some international stuff. That is scheduled for July the 7th. Right now, we have the three legal beagles here in the studio with us, and you know, I even if he had caused his own mental disabilities through drugs and substance abuse, could he not have been legally retarded at the time he did the crime?
Go back there, Lay. These things have to onset before the age of 18. That's a big
thing. Well, I hear you say that, but I'm worrying about it. I mean, if you've stewed your brain so you're stupid, and then you do something, then you get executed because you were stupid after you were 18?
The law has always been, right or wrong, that voluntary use of drugs
is a culpability.
Intoxication does not, you don't escape, it's not a defense. It may be a mitigating factor, but it's not a defense to it. And the question in this case is, was he mentally retarded before the age of 18? Did all these characteristics crop out before he was 18, or is he faking it, or did his self-induced use of drugs lower his IQ? If that did, that's just shame on you. They're not going to cut him a break for it. Because, again, they have that 18-year cutoff, and that came from the mental health people, who is the one that defined mental retardation that way and is adopted by the state of Texas. And that's what hurts you, because they always go back and look at school records, like Susan pointed out. He had at least a 79 IQ when he was in the fifth grade. And see, a lot of that is difficult to determine, because I've often said that, especially kiddos, and from his background, he was raised kind of in a ghetto area, according to him.
Yeah.
He claimed he was raised around prostitutes and pimps. And I'm not sure IQ test is a good measure of an intellect of somebody with what we call street knowledge. Because I'm not sure that even the vernaculars.
Yeah, I can see the difference.
We've talked about that before.
Sure.
Because I've often said if the drug dealers wrote the IQ test, they'd be geniuses, and psychologists would be the retarded ones. So.
But you're in a prison, and we got not just on the row, but people all over Texas prisons can hear us now that we're on this venue as opposed to HD venue. Prison is full of people who got drunk, stoned, and did the most incredible, stupid thing they could imagine. And they got all kinds of time for it, and some of them are sitting on death row for it. And the fact that the state is not going to cut you any slack for your yielding to your addictions and getting in that state of mind, because you were culpable when you turned left instead of right, because that's the way the crack dealer was or the liquor store was. Fellers that are listening, that's why I don't care how much time you're doing, how much time you've done, or how much time you plan to do. Understand that one of the responsibilities that you have as an adult human being, currently sober enough to listen to me, is to do something about your addictions. Now's the time. You may get out. And when you get out, going and getting stoned and drunk and stupid is not going to be any relief from future sentences. And at some point, it's time for you to decide you've had enough. It is 6:43, and we don't have Claudia's apparently not coming in. We had scheduled to interview Claudia. Now Elizabeth tells me she's coming in. It's going to take a minute to get her come in. And Claudia is a national figure, and she works with the National Coalition to Abolish Death Penalty and for National Cure. CURE is the Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants. We just went to their Texas event over in Brenham, Texas, where we were greeted by the county judge of that county, and Washington County is where that is. And he explained to me what county judges worry about in the condition of drought. But CURE is Texas's original criminal justice reform group. A strange name, Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants, and most of you woke up this morning not knowing you were errant. Claudia, this is Ray Hill. You're on the air.
Hi, Ray. It's so nice to talk to you again. It's been quite a few years since Billy Hughes' execution.
Has it been that long, Claudia?
Yes, it has.
Well, that I am still anguishing over that. I'm not going to let that go away anytime soon. I understand that you, too, got one of his cartoons.
I did. I got a letter, I guess, a couple of days after he was executed with one of his wonderful drawings and just saying that they were riding off into the sunset and thanking all of us for being there. And, of course, you and Billy knew the secret about Michael Moore being there.
Yep. I wouldn't cooperate. I wouldn't cooperate unless Billy knew that.
Yeah, it was amazing. Well, he never gave up the secret, but as our Billy had his last laugh.
Claudia, have you been following this particular case? You know what we're talking about here?
Yes, I have not been following Mr. Mathis's case for a long time, but I've been following it tonight. And I know the Supreme Court denied him, but apparently there's still an appeal pending.
No, they have now crossed this road, which means that the execution is going through. They crossed the road in a report from Gloria at 6:37, which meant that it was about a half hour, a little over a half hour late beginning the process. And we're waiting word from Gloria that the media has come out. So the execution is taking place right now.
I'm so sorry, and I, you know, even though it's in this process, I certainly want to express my sorrow both for the Brown and Hibbert families as well as the Mathis family and for anybody who was involved in this terrible mess. I just feel, as always, that this does not help anybody really very much and certainly does not bring closure.
No, it doesn't. What got you involved in execution abolition work anyway?
Well, I started quite a few. I was always against the death penalty, but I've been an activist all my life, and I got involved in other things because it was not a thing that was really going on very often in a lot of the years when I was involved in other activism. And it was actually the case of Mumia Abu-Jabal and Philadelphia that first got me involved in reading about it, and I actually sat in court in 1995, I think, and saw his judge and how he behaved and the whole horrible mess of an unfair trial, and just from that moment on, it's basically been what I've done, is work against the death penalty. And I run the death penalty chapter for CURE, which, of course, you know very well since it started in Texas, and you know Charlie Sullivan.
Yeah. Yep, Charlie and I and Pauline and I have gone through a lot, and those are two saints as far as I'm concerned.
I absolutely agree. I was just with them in Baton Rouge at our conference a couple of weeks ago, and they are amazing and continue to be amazing.
Yeah, while they were on that tour, they came over here, and we went to Brenham, Texas to celebrate the Contact Visit Legislation 25th anniversary.
Wow.
And so that kind of grassroots work. Claudia, this is your first time of being with us on the radio.
Actually not. I've been on your show a couple of times.
Well, I know, but now Execution Watch, things have changed. We have a good audience of guys on the row that tune in this particular show. They know when Execution Watch is going to happen because someone has been removed from their immediate surround. And so they're tuning in, and they're paying a special attention. So you can talk directly to people on Texas death row. What have you to say to them?
Well, I certainly want to say hello to Ivan Cantu. I know him personally and visited with him, I guess, a couple of years ago. And he has a date for August 30th, and I'm very upset about that. And I want to say that to everybody out there, I think my handbook, actually, the Capital Defense Handbook for Defendants and Their Families, was sent, Nancy Bailey arranged a few years ago, and everybody who was on the row at that time got a copy of it, and it continues to go free to anybody who asks for it. And I've done quite a few trainings in Texas over the years with death row families and advocacy people. And I just want to say I'm always available. I spend 70 hours a week at least, and every day and most waking hours thinking about how horrible the death penalty is for everybody, and certainly for victims and their families. And that there are those of us, maybe not enough of us, but we're out here working all the time trying to stop this insanity.
How do people get in touch with you?
Well, probably there are a lot of handbooks on the row, and they can certainly ask somebody to see one. Anyone in their family can look up my organization, or you can look it up under CURE, since I run the death penalty chapter. If you're looking for it on any way, it's called the National Death Row Assistance Network of CURE. On the internet, if somebody's family is looking, it's www.ndran. Those are the letters, the of National Death Row Assistance Network, ndran.org. And I can be written to. I get quite a few letters from people. I get about 100 letters a month from people all over the country. And I'm always available to come back to Texas and do a training with families at no cost. So anyone who is interested should have their families contact me. You know, we need a bit of a group, maybe 10 people or so. I've done them in Houston and Dallas. I'm willing to come wherever. Also down near Mexico border.
Well, Claudia, next time you're in the neighborhood, let's coffee up.
I would love to. I also want to say hello to Rudy Medrano, too.
Okay.
Okay, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Claudia.
And I'm very, very sorry about
this.
Yes,
I'm sorry. And it's getting close to the end of the hour, and we need to
nice to be in touch with you again, Ray.
Thank you, Claudia. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Claudia, and Claudia is with National CURE. You can just go to www.curenational.org, and that's all linked up that way. That's a good way to do it. Elizabeth is on the phone, I presume, talking to Gloria, and when she gets ready, is that Gloria? I can't tell. She's it was an incoming call, so I don't know what's going on in Huntsville. Sometimes Elizabeth and Gloria will start chatting about their puppies or something and get a little disjointed from the program here. But we have got about 6 minutes left, and there's no sense in wasting the energy of all these fine legal minds in here. Jim, you want to begin a wrap-up?
Again, I just think the facts and our definition of what qualifies mentally retarded is why I ended this case.
Susan?
I would say that, you know, you have to consider more than just the number on the IQ score, because obviously his IQ, whether it really went down afterwards when he was tested at TDCJ and later during the state proceeding, it's impossible to say if his IQ really did go down because of drug use or if he had a disincentive to score well, being that they were going to execute him. It's really impossible to say. And so part of the definition is adaptive behavior and their functional skills. And so I think that's probably an important part of evaluating it. Like, can this person, shall we say, take a bus from one place to another, buy groceries, feed themselves, socially interact.
Every one of the reports that you gave in this research indicated that in addition to whatever his IQ was, no matter when it got there, he had other adaptive living problems.
Yes.
I listened carefully to everything
yes.
you said. So
yes.
every
he
report
did.
Said that. And so, Gloria, is that you?
Yes, I'm here, Ray.
Okay, tell us.
Well, actually, the witnesses haven't come yet. We've got about, what, 6-7 minutes? Oh, well, I spoke too soon. The witnesses are walking out.
Which means
the execution is over. I was looking for Milton's mom, who is an exceptionally tall woman with blonde hair, and I don't see her. So I was just talking to somebody who was friends. I can't tell who the spiritual advisors were. It doesn't look like Catherine Cox. Okay, well, the witnesses did just walk out, and so execution number 470 is taking place. To Milton's friends on death row, I am so, so sorry that this happened. I know that he left a lot of good friends behind. And this execution has happened. The next one, Ray, will be another one that has not only garnered news coverage here in Texas,
but all over the world.
Has made the editorial page of the New York Times. And I'm hoping that Humberto Leal will get a stay before July 7th. I know the abolition movement is working with his lawyer, and we're going to be having a press conference probably next week with different organizations and individuals particularly from the Latino community to talk about this situation.
Gloria, it's time for me to do my rap.
Okay.
Thank you for your services. My sympathy to the other vigilants there in Huntsville.
Oh, that's right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And you're listening to Execution Watch on radio station KPFT in Houston. You also can get it on KPFT HD Channel 1, or it comes to you via two websites, executionwatch.org, executionwatch.org, and KPFT. Or.org. We do this only when there's an execution. The next one scheduled is for July the 7th. It's for Humberto Leal. Much has been written and said about that case. It's interesting. Today did not begin as we expected to do. We call Glory and they cross the road and the execution begins. But there was a glitch in the come along, and so the execution began after the half hour, and it was apparently completed only in time for us to do this wrap-up and tell you that Mr. Milton Mathis, has been executed. He is now dead. His family can go to the funeral home and visit the body while it is still warm. I know that is depressingly awful, but that's what happens because people on death row cannot touch the people that care about them as long as they are there. So we have no idea how many years the warmth of his body has not been shared by those he cares for. We don't like doing this, but we do it. We want to thank everybody on the staff. I want to thank Susan Ashley. I want to thank Larry Douglas. I want to thank Jim Skelton for doing a very fine job of analyzing the case for you. This is only possible because of the hard work of Elizabeth Ann Stein. Our technical director and keeper of the website is Otis McClay, and you're hearing Victoria Panetti sing as we go out. My name is Ray Hill. Have a good night. I hope I never have to do this show again.